Okay, start just from the beginning of the Sedra. The Torah says that Vayakel Moshe es kol adas b'nei Yisrael. The Mishkan was a unifying factor, both unified heaven and earth, and unified the Jewish people. And there are three kinds of unity: Kahal, Adas, Yisrael. And they basically are the following. The Kahal is literally a congregation. People congregate together. Vayikohalu ha-Yehudim, it says in Megillas Esther. A congregation means physically. People congregate together in the same place, and they do things together. There's strength in numbers. The Gemara says that Eino dome yochid osis ha-mitzvah l'rabim osim ha-mitzvah. There's no comparison of an individual doing a mitzvah and a lot of people together doing a mitzvah. And or barova mahadris melech, the more people doing a mitzvah together, the more honor it is for the Rabbanu Shalom. So in that respect, the kahal is a physical unity in order to have strength in numbers. That's kahal. Then there's an eda. An eda is another kind of congregation. But that's the congregation of the spirit. An Eda, we learned it from the Meraglim. Wasn't necessarily that they were all together, it's just that they all had the same purpose. Unfortunately, there was a negative purpose. An Eda is a meeting of the minds, not a meeting of the bodies. And therefore you can be scattered all around the world, but still be an Eda. Eda, some say, comes from the word edus, that they all testify to the same ideas, principles, and so on. And some say that, I think it comes from the word yad. Yad means they all have the same destination, right? In the airport, on the board, right? Destination is yad. So an Eda are people who have common goals, common principles, common ideas, right? And that's what unites them. And they don't have to be in the same place. That's an Eda. And the last thing is Yisrael. Yisrael, the Zohar says, is the acronym for Yeshishim Ribui Osios LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah. Simple idea being that there are 600,000 root souls of the Jewish people. There are more than 600,000 Jews, but we're all connected to a certain root soul. There are 600,000 root souls, are like clusters. And there are 600,000 clusters, and every Jew belongs to one of those 600,000 clusters. And just like there are 600,000 letters in the Torah, every Jew has a letter. Every cluster of souls is connected to a letter of the Torah, which is a very nice idea, except there's one problem. There aren't 600,000 letters in the Torah. So you'll say, okay, it's a gematria, you know, plus or minus one or two doesn't make that much of a difference. So how many letters are there? 304,588, which is less, about, right, right, which is about half, which... unless we have the Reader's Digest condensed version, something's missing. So how could there be 600,000 letters? There's only 304,000 letters. So there are many answers. I know about 11 answers to the question. Amongst them, you have to count the Targum. Or you have to count the white spaces between the letters. Because the Torah was black fire on white fire. That means the white fire, the surface, is also part of the Torah. I remember in the children's books years ago, remember Humpty Dumpty magazine in America, so they had, from every once in a while, they had these optical illusions. And one of them was something that if you looked at the black, it was a wine goblet. If you looked at the white, it was a wine goblet. If you looked at the black, you saw two people facing each other. So the Torah also... if you look, every halacha is that every letter has to be surrounded by parchment. Can't be letters stuck together, or because the background is part of the appearance of the Torah. In other words, you can look at the Torah and not see the black, but see the white, and that is also a letter. So the letters are both the black and the white in between, so it comes out to about double the amount. Okay. There are many other answers. Others say that the letters themselves are made up of many letters, except then it comes out to much more than 600,000. In any case, whatever it may be, I don't think there's any question. There's only need answers if there's a question. The question would only be if it said, Yeshishim ribui osios batorah. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah. But if it would say that, it wouldn't spell Yisrael. It would spell Yisra'ab. In order to spell Yisrael, it has to read Yeshishim ribui osios la Torah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah, which I think means the following. There's another Zohar, famous one. Yisrael, V'oraisa, V'kudsha b'richu chadu. The Jewish people, the Torah, and the Rabbans are one. If that's the case, then what it means is the following. There are 300,000 letters in the written Torah, but that's not complete, because you have to add another 600,000 letters to make it complete. What are those 600,000 letters? The souls of the Jewish people. If you don't connect the Jewish people to the Torah, it's not complete. So, Yeshishim ribui osios la Torah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah that have to be added in order to make it complete. Those are the 600,000 letters. Just as an aside, the 600,000 did not count the Levium. The Levium were another 22,000. So how come they're not included? They don't have letters in the Torah? How come it says only Shishim ribui osios and the Levium are not there? So once one did a say that the Levium are another part, there's letters in the Torah, there's something else in the Torah, it's called Sirtut. Sirtut means the lines that you make in the parchment before you write the lines in the Torah, before you write the letters. And that is Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. The Torah has to have Sirtut, and it's not with color, it's you take a blunt instrument and you indent lines on the parchment. If you look at a Sefer Torah, even look at a mezuzah. Mezuzahs also have sirtut. Look at a mezuzah, you'll see that there's lines indented in the parchment, and that's part of the halacha of the Sefer Torah. It has to be there. And those lines are not, again, made with a color, with an ink or whatever, but just indented in the parchment. And I said that maybe that's what the Levium were, right? They weren't letters. What's the purpose of the sirtut? Simplest purpose is you write the letters on that line where the top of the letter is on the line in order to make it straight, to make sure that it, that you can read it properly and every letter follows the one, you know what, it's all one straight line. It also gives the letter something to look up to, the line above it. That's the Levium. The Levium keep the Jewish people straight and they give them something to look up to. So they are the sirtut. Then I started to make a calculation and I found something very interesting. According to the minig of how we write a Sefer Torah, how many columns, how many lines in a column, it's all dependent on minig, right? Theoretically, you could make a Sefer Torah, that's 10 miles long with two lines on every column, right? But Lemaisa, what's it called? According to the minig we have, there are 11,000 lines in the written Torah. Approximately 11,000 lines. Figuring out how many columns, how many lines per column, comes out to about 11,000. That's in a Sefer Torah of 300,000 letters. Mm-hmm. If you had a double Sefer Torah of 600,000 letters, it would come out to be 22,000. It's exactly the number of the Levium. So maybe there's something to this idea. Okay. Okay. So that is the idea of Yisrael. Yisrael is a different kind of unity. The first two are everybody doing basically the same thing. Either we have common goals, ideals, principles that unite us, and that's all the same, or we are doing the same thing together as many people doing the same thing together. That's Kahal. Yisrael is where everybody contributes their unique part towards the whole. We're not doing the same thing. Every letter in the Torah is different. Not only 27 different letters, every letter is unique. Because the Beis and Bereishis is not the same Beis as Bara. Because the Beis and Bereishis is followed by nothing, is preceded by nothing and followed by a word, Reish, Aleph, Shin, Yud, Tov. The Beis and Bara is preceded by a word, Bereishis, and followed by a Reish, Aleph. So the position of every letter makes it unique. Right? Where it is, what sentence it's in, what words precede it, what words come after it. It makes it unique. So every Jew is unique. Right? It's unique in what letter he is and where he is. Right? And what precedes him and who he interacts with or whatever. So there, not everybody's doing the same thing, but everybody is contributing towards the same purpose, their unique part. That's Israel. And I think that was also echoed in the Mishkan. Because in the Mishkan there were three donations that were made, three trumos. There was a truma made for the Adonim, for the foundation of the Mishkan, right? The sockets which the boards went into, the crushim went into. And that was equal. Everybody gave the same thing, the same amount. Half a shekel of silver for the sockets. Then there was another truma, a half a shekel for the upkeep of the karbonos. Right? That the public communal sacrifices were bought from that money that was given, half a shekel from every Jew. And the third one was the materials that went into building the Mishkan. And that everybody gave something different. This one gave a different amount and different materials and so on. So that represents the thing. The Adonim is the physical foundation of the Mishkan. That is representing of the Kahal. The Kahal is the physical infrastructure of the Tzibur. Physical, what's it called? That's the Adonim. That everybody's equal. Then there is a spiritual foundation of the Mishkan, which is the sacrifices. That everybody's equal in also. Everybody gives a half a shekel towards that. Right, everybody's equal. That's the Eda. The Eda is the unity of everybody having the same goals, purposes, or whatever. And then the third Truma is unique. Everybody's different. That's Israel. That's everybody is their own letter, their own unique portion that they contribute towards the whole. So I think that signifies the Mishkan, Kahal, Adas, Israel, Vayakel Moshe. There's the Kahal. Es Kol Adas, Bnei Israel, and the Truma to the Mishkan represented these three kinds of unity. Okay. The first thing the Torah speaks about is Shabbos. And the rabbis say the fact that the Torah spoke about Shabbos before it spoke about the Mishkan is to tell me that Shabbos precedes the Mishkan, and you can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Okay? Not only that, but the works that went into building the Mishkan are specifically those things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. 39 malachos that went into building the Mishkan. First of all, why, Taka, are those 39 things the things that you can't do on Shabbos? So one idea is that the Mishkan was like a microcosm. It was like a small model, physically, spiritually, of the universe. So the malachos that went into building the Mishkan were basically our concept of building the universe. It was the Mishkan and creation have a tremendous connection one with the other, as the Kli Yoker points out in the beginning of the Sedra. First of all, we find that the Rabbanu Shalom made the world with two midos. In the beginning, midos hadin, and then he added midos harachamim. So it was both the attribute of justice and the attribute of mercy combined to make this world. Who made the Mishkan? Bezalel and Ahaliyav. Bezalel was from Shevet Yehuda, which has God's name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, in his name, which is a Midas HaRachamim. And Aliyav is from Shevet Don. Don is Elohim, is Din. So you see that the Mishkan also was created with Rachamim and Din, those two attributes, just like the world was created. We find that at the end of the building of the Mishkan, in next week's Sedra, it says, Vayichal Moshe lahokim es haMishkan, just like it says at the end of creation, Vayichulu hashamayim v'haaretz. And after it was finished, God blessed the world. Vayivorech Elokim. That's Yom HaShavi, right? And it says Moshe Rabbeinu blessed them when they finished building the Mishkan. The Mishkan itself, it says, when you went inside with the hooks that were in the coverings, it looked like a planetarium. It looked like the stars in the sky. It looked like a little universe. And in addition to that, there's another thing the Kliyokar says. It says that when the world was created, God had to say, stop. It was expanding and expanding until the Rabban Shem said, die. That's why God is called Shakai, Sha'omar La'olamo, die. Because the world was expanding and expanding, and God stopped the expansion. So he says the same thing happened in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan also, we find that people donated more than enough, and Moshe had to say, stop. Enough, right? What's it called? Stop, no more. Al Yavi Yosef. Don't bring any more. And the Kliyokar says, what's the significance? Because both of these things are symbolic of the universe, and a human being is a small universe. We also can expand into places that we shouldn't be. We have to know how to say stop, how to say enough. So when the universe was made, and the microcosm that is the Mishkan was made, it also followed the same pattern, that it was expanding and expanding until somebody said stop. And therefore a person has to be, he's a small universe also, has to know when to say enough, when to say stop. So Mishkan was the so therefore the malachos that went into building the Mishkan is our concept of creating the world, because we're creating that little microcosm. So the things that are prohibited on Shabbos to show that God ceased from creating the world, we cease from doing those things that are, in our estimation, creating our world, making the Mishkan. That's one idea. Another idea is the purpose of the Mishkan, what's it called, of the purpose of Shabbos. One of the purposes of Shabbos is to prohibit work, not because something's wrong with work, just the opposite. Because when you're in the middle of working, you can't really appreciate what you're doing. And you begin to lose sight of the importance of work. And you begin to think work is just for the sake of earning a living. But the truth is that work in this physical world is very important, because it builds the world. And the proof is that the works that went into building the Mishkan created a place where God's presence had come into this world. So look what work can accomplish. So you need one day to step back to be able to appreciate. When you have a painting, if you get too close, you don't appreciate the painting. You have to step back and see it in its splendor, then you can appreciate it. Same thing, when you're in the midst of something, you lose sight of its importance. Sometimes you have to stop doing it for a while and take a step back to appreciate what it is. So the day of Shabbos is to give you an understanding of how important work is and how it should be done properly. And then you can go to Sunday and start working again. If that's the case, what was the greatest work that ever was done? The building of the Mishkan created a place where God's presence could come. So we stop doing those works on Shabbos to be able to appreciate their importance. That's why the 39 malachos are the malachos of Shabbos. Why 39? Because the number 40 is always a representation of a new creation. Right? Why? Because in nature, it takes 40 days for the embryo to form, Yetziras Havlad. That doesn't mean that after 40 days a kid's ready to be born. Okay? Many women would love that, but it's not the case. Right? So what does it mean, Yetziras Havlad is 40 days? What I think it means, and I have proof from the March of Dimes, what I think it means is the following. That the major systems of the body that determine what a human being is and looks like are already formed in the first 40 days. After that, it's growth. It's not formation. I saw a pamphlet years ago in America from the March of Dimes deals with birth defects. I don't even know if they're around anymore, but in any case, at least they have telethons. They marched. Right. So used to have telethons or whatever for the. So I saw a pamphlet they put out warning women to be extra careful not to take medicines and drink alcohol the first trimester of their, what's it called, of their pregnancy, which is basically the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, because they said it's during that time that the embryo is, the major systems are being formed. What? Well, that maybe it's not trimester. It's what's it called? They said the first 6 weeks. Why?
Women would settle for 18 weeks also.
Right. They said the first 6 weeks because that's when the major systems of the body are being formed, and it's very possible then to interrupt them and to cause terrible birth defects. Once they're formed, and it's only a matter of growth, there's not too much more that could go wrong. Right. So those 6 weeks are crucial. Right. 6 weeks is 42 days. So the scientists were only off by 2 days. The rabbi said exactly 40 days. They said approximately 42 days. Same thing. So in nature, a new formation, it takes 40 days. So the number 40 represents whenever there's a need for a new formation, you have 40. The flood destroyed an old world, started a new world. 40 days and 40 nights of rain. The Torah was given 40 days and 40 nights. The world before the Torah was given, the world after is a different world. So 40 day new formation. What else was 40 years in the desert. An old generation died out and a new generation was formed. There are two things that are 39, but the Torah, the Gemara does not call them 39, calls them 40 minus 1. Malchus, right? You get lashes for sins that you do. And Shabbos, the Malachas of Shabbos. So I was thinking, why is it 40 minus 1? The rabbis wanted to test us to see if we know how to subtract. Why did they say 39? Why 40 minus 1? So, in fact, the Torah itself describes it, the Mispar Arboy, the number that leads to 40. But it's not 40, it's only 39. So why? I was thinking, because Malchus, it says, takes the place of death. Really, a person does a sin, he forfeits his life. Because you were given life on condition that you keep the mitzvahs. You don't keep them, you forfeit your life. But God is very merciful. And he took Malchus in place of death. In other words, hitting a person and weakening them is a partial death. It's like a death in quality. Partial, take away quality of life of a person for temporarily, it's like killing him. So God considered like dying, and that's why it says after the person is hit, right, gets his malchus, he's like a new person. V'niklo achicha, once he's hit, he becomes your brother again. Right? It transforms him. So it's like the person died and was resurrected. But it's not exactly. So it's like 40, but it's not exactly 40. It's 40 minus 1. Right? It's a new formation, but only like a new formation. Same thing with Shabbos. Shabbos is me'ein olam haba. It's like the world to come. It's like a new formation, a new creation. But it's not exactly the world to come, because you get Saturday night, you go back to this world. So it's like the world to come. So it's 40 minus 1. Okay. So those are the 39 malachas that are us, are the ones going to build the Mishkan, and you can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Because, and how do we know that? Because the Torah mentions Shabbos before it mentions the Mishkan. Says the Meshech Chachma, that's very nice in Parshas Vayakra. But in Parshas Kisisa, last week's Sedra, the Torah mentions Shabbos after the Mishkan. So if there wouldn't be any Parshas Vayakra, only Kisisa, says the Meshech Chachma, it would seem to be implied that the Mishkan takes precedence over Shabbos. And you can build the Mishkan on Shabbos. In addition, there's a question, L'chora, what you do in the Mishkan, the upkeep of the Mishkan, lighting the menorah, making sacrifices, many of them do supersede the Shabbos, and you're allowed to do them on Shabbos, even though they're normally things that are prohibited. Burning fires on the Mizbeach, right, making the Ketores, lighting the menorah, all is done on Shabbos. Right, so why building the Mishkan not, but using the Mishkan, yes? So I want to say the following. Say that there are two different functions to the Mishkan, which we explained, I think, last week. One function is that it's the place where you feel God's presence. You have to come to the Mishkan to feel God's presence, And then once you feel God's presence, then you serve God in the Mishkan. That's one aspect of the Mishkan. However, before the sin of the golden calf, that was not necessary. Because any place in the world you could feel God's presence. You didn't need to come to the Mishkan to feel God's presence. So what was the purpose of the Mishkan before the sin of the golden calf? And there was to be a Mishkan even before the sin. After the sin, the Mishkan took on a new dimension of being an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. But had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there still would have been a Mishkan. But would have had a different function. You wouldn't have needed the Mishkan to feel God's presence. You would feel God's presence anywhere in the world. You would come to the Mishkan to serve God's presence. Right? To take that feeling and put it into practice. And you needed the kelim, the various vessels of the Mishkan, to put it into practice, to bring sacrifice or whatever. You felt God's presence, you felt the closeness, now put it into something concrete. And we've mentioned that that's the purpose of the physical world. The physical things are there to arouse you to feelings, motions create emotions, and once you have those emotions, now put them again into a physical framework, because that's more concrete and more real. So there's two aspects. So the physical plant of the Mishkan before the sin of the golden calf was only to give you the ability to put the emotions you got everywhere in the world into practice in the Mishkan, to put them into a concrete framework. After the sin of the golden calf, the Mishkan served two purposes. One, to arouse you to a feeling of God's presence, and then to give you the ability to put it into that, and put it into the framework, to use it. We don't put on tefillin on Shabbos. Why? Because tefillin is considered a sign that God exists, and it's an oath, and Shabbos is a sign that God exists. If we put tefillin on Shabbos, it would decrease from the importance of Shabbos. Because why do you need another sign? Right? Shabbos tells you that God's around. Why do you need tefillin to tell you that? So it would be an affront to Shabbos if we put on tefillin, as if Shabbos is not enough. So we don't put on tefillin on Shabbos. One of the reasons. Before the sin of the, after the sin of the golden calf, where you needed the Mishkan to make you feel God's presence, that building the Mishkan would be an affront to Shabbos. Why do I need to build a place on Shabbos where I could feel God's presence if Shabbos itself makes me feel God's presence? The Shabbos itself, if God's presence is more, tangible in the world. God's presence comes into the world on Shabbos. That's the Kiddush. In fact, the Torah refers to Shabbos as a mikdash. The Shabbos is a mikdash. It's a place where you feel God's holiness. You feel His presence. The holiness of Shabbos affects the same thing as the holiness of the mikdash. It's called a mikdash. So therefore, building the mikdash on Shabbos would be an affront to Shabbos. Why do you need a place to make you feel God's presence? You have Shabbos. Shabbos should make you feel God's presence. Just like you don't put on tefillin on Shabbos, there's no need to build a mishkan on Shabbos. That's after the sin of the golden calf, where you needed the Mishkan to make you feel God's presence. That came in contradiction to Shabbos. But before the sin of the golden calf, like we said, the purpose of the Mishkan wasn't to make you feel God's presence. It was only to serve God's presence. That you can do on Shabbos. That's not an affront to Shabbos. So therefore, you can make sacrifices in the Mishkan on Shabbos. You can light the menorah. That's all serving God's presence. That's not establishing God's presence. Establishing God's presence on Shabbos is unnecessary because you have Shabbos. But serving God's presence doesn't contradict Shabbos at all. So therefore, you can make sacrifices. You can light the menorah on Shabbos, but you can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. But that's only after the sin of the golden calf. Before the sin of the golden calf, the purpose of the Mishkan was only to serve God's presence, not to create it, not to, right. Therefore, before the sin of the golden calf in last week's Sedra, had it not been for the sin of the golden calf, you would have been allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Therefore, Shabbos comes after the Mishkan. This week's Sedra is already after the sin of the golden calf. after the sin of the golden calf, you can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos because it would be an affront to Shabbos to say that you need to create a feeling of God's presence on Shabbos when Shabbos itself should give you that feeling. So that's the difference between the two parshios. Okay, in addition to that, Shabbos in this week's Sedra is referred to in the mail. Right? Kol ha'osa bo malacha mos yumas. Whoever does work on Shabbos, bo is referring to Shabbos as masculine. In last week's Sedra, the Torah referred to the Shabbos as feminine. V'shamru v'nei sos ha'shabbos, lasos es ha'shabbos ador ha'somri salam, os hi, b'ni uvein b'nei Yisrael. Referring to the Shabbos as what's it called, feminine. Or it says after that, mechalaleha, mos yumos. He who desecrates the Shabbos, referring to the Shabbos as nekeva. So to explain in the past, Shabbos has two ideas to it. It has a male aspect and a female aspect. Male has nothing to do with men and women per se, but it's a concept in nature. The male aspect in nature is referring to the giver. There's mashpim, those that give, and those that receive. It applies to electricity, to plumbing, or whatever. There are male fittings and female fittings and whatever in electricity and plumbing. It's not to do with men and women. It does, really, but it's just a euphemism, right? A woman could be a giver. In that respect, she is basically functioning with a male role. A man could be a receiver. In that respect, he is functioning in a female role. So it has nothing to do with men and women per se. It's a concept in nature, spiritual and physical. And therefore, in Hebrew, there are words that are male and words that are female, even in inanimate objects, because it refers to this idea. Therefore, Shabbos has a male aspect to it, and Shabbos has a female aspect. The Friday night aspect of Shabbos is the female aspect. Shabbos is called Kala, Malka, right? Boi Chala. That's the Friday night. Shabbos morning is the Zohar aspect of Shabbos, which is Zohar, which is male. That's why Friday night in davening we say V'yanuchu Va, female, and Shabbos morning we say V'yanuchu Vo. But since Shomer V'Zohar, these two aspects are really one, they complement and supplement each other, so Shabbos Mincha, we put them together, Shomer V'Zohar, and we said V'yanuchu Ba, plural, both together. What is this idea of Shabbos being masculine and feminine? So we've explained in the past that Shabbos has two lessons to it. One lesson tells me that by refraining from working on Shabbos, I'm making a statement that this is not my world. It's God's world, and He can tell me when I can use it and when not. Because if it's my world, I can use it anytime I want. Not answering the phone on Shabbos is making a tremendous statement. It's not my phone. I mean, one of the biggest nisyonos, one of the hardest things to do is not to answer a ringing phone, right? How could you not answer? It's like the phone is telling you, answer me, right? So it's your phone, yeah, you answer it. If it's not your phone, it belongs to Orange or Cellcom or whatever, so they're the ones who can tell you when to answer it or not. But if it's God, and He says one day it's off limits, then Cellcom can't tell you to answer it, and you can't answer it, it's not yours. So by not answering that phone one day a week, you're making a statement, I believe this is not my world. I'm not the boss over here, I'm just a created being, and I have to fit into the framework that God gave me, and therefore God gave me 6 days to use the world and to create and to be very active, and one day He told me it's off limits. So in that respect, our keeping the Shabbos really makes the Shabbos. Because if you ignore the Shabbos and you answer that phone, right, you drive in your car. So for all practical purposes, you're not making any statement. The Shabbos, the significance of Shabbos depends on you making that statement. That's what it says. V'shamru v'nei Yisrael sa'Shabbos. When we observe the Shabbos, lasos, we make the Shabbos. Because if we ignore it and we don't observe the Shabbos, then basically Shabbos is irrelevant. Because by not observing it, we're making it irrelevant. In that respect, Shabbos receives from us. When we observe the Shabbos, we make the Shabbos. So Shabbos is the receiver and we're the giver. Then in that respect, Shabbos is feminine. Shabbos is the receiver. There's another aspect of Shabbos. Shabbos confers on us tremendous importance. Because Shabbos is me'ein olam haba. Shabbos is an echo of the world to come. We make the world to come. Right? By living in this world properly, we create our world to come. And Shabbos represents the fact that we are very special, that we are the partners with God in creation. Shabbos being an echo of the world to come confers on us importance. So then Shabbos is the giver, and we are the receiver. Shabbos in its essence is like the world to come, which shows how important we are, because God created this whole world just that we should get the world to come. So Shabbos gives to us. We're the female and Shabbos is the male. That is Zochras Yom HaShabbos. Remember the Shabbos to sanctify it. Shabbos is like Olam Haba. Then Shabbos is the Zohar and we're the Nekeva. That's in the daytime. So first you have to have the idea that you're not the boss here. You have to fit into God's framework. Once you understand that, in that framework, you're very important. Then you are the pinnacle of creation. If you think you're the boss, you're nothing. If you understand that you're a created being, then you're very important, because in that scheme of creation, you were created to be the purpose of creation. So they go together, right? The two ideas go together. But first you have to have the idea of knowing that you're not the boss. Then, so the Shabbos first starts out female, where you make the Shabbos significant. And then Shabbos becomes male in the daytime. That's why in the Chadodi, right, it says, Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Even though in the Torah, it's the opposite order. In Yisro, it says, Zachor Yom HaShabbos. In V'eschanan, it says, Shomer Yom HaShabbos. So Shlomo HaKabetz should have wrote Zohar v'Shomer b'Dibur Echad. Why Shomer v'Zohar? So it wouldn't have been Shlomo. The only problem with that is that I could figure out a way to put it in the right order and still be Shlomo. Like Shabbos, Zohar v'Shomer b'Dibur Echad. Right? And you could fit it into the poetry also. So he could have figured that out too. So the answer is that no, chronologically, the Shomer part of Shabbos comes first, Friday night. And then the Zohar. So why did the Torah say it in the opposite order? Why did the Torah say Zohar first and then Shomer? Because the Torah speaks about the goal. And then it tells you the means to reach that goal. The goal is Zohar. The goal is that you should realize how important you are. But in order to do that, you have to understand what framework you fit into. So the means is the Shomer. But the goal is Zohar. So the Torah first mentions the goal. Zohar Shomer Shabbos. Then it tells you how to get there. Shomer. But in chronological order, first you have to do the Shomer, then the Zohar. So on every Shabbos, the Shomer part precedes the Zohar part. So that is why in this week's Sedra, Shabbos is male, and the last week's Parsha, the Shabbos is the female.